Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart, and for the last 40 years, I've interviewed thousands of veterans.
Oh, give it a rest. You're under new management. It's Pete and Gary's Military History Podcast now.
Hello, I'm Peter Hart, and I'm with Gary, Gary Bain. Oh, he's so lovely. And you're in particularly song and poetry form today, aren't you, Gary?
Hello, is it me you're looking for?
No.
I can see it in your eyes. I can feel it in your touch.
Something wrong with your eyesight. I'm scowling.
Hello, hello, hello.
What are we doing today, Gary?
Well, today we're doing playing with Great War poets.
Oh, what type of play?
Well, the poetry type. And it's brought out the inner poet in me. And I'm going to revisit a poem that proved deeply unpopular. Well, certainly with you.
No.
Oh, dear old Fred, it must be said, you're often very smelly. When you let rip, I'm often sick. And legs reduced to jelly.
I hope he's in the room with you.
That was...
And can express...
That was sort of Sassoon-like, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a bit Sassoon-like.
Unfortunately, Vidal. Well, anyway, this is a real departure for us. I'm really not...
You said before it started, this one's going to be crap.
I didn't say crap. I said disastrous. Oh, dear.
Well, I think it's going to be... I mean, some of them are difficult to read, aren't they?
Yes.
It's probably the emotion, Gary.
Yeah, and I should say, you know, I should make an admission here. I do not understand poetry at all. It goes straight over my head. Any hidden messaging or, you know, anything like that, I just completely miss.
Yes, but you're a great poet yourself, apparently.
Well, I know about dogs and their smells, yeah.
Yeah, you certainly do. Right, well, we're going to start with the old cliche, Wilfred Owen. But we're not starting with that the one that you think we're going to start. We're going to start with a poem called The Letter. Now, tell us a bit about... You're going to read this, aren't you? Tell us a bit about the poem. You found this one and it appealed to you, didn't it, in some way?
Yeah, I mean, it was written in Ripon in 1918 when Owen was preparing to return to France. And it's one of the more tiresome duties of an officer to censor the letters of his men. Literary critics have claimed that despite his, shall we say, lower middle class background, Owen had a good understanding of the working class men he commanded. Let
people decide, because this sounds to me more like a pastiche, and quite an offensive one in some ways, so I don't go along with that. Anyway, you're going to read it. So I think before we start, we'd better say you're going to try and read it.
Yeah, and a pastiche, for the less informed, Pete, that's what, like a cartoon, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, for my benefit. Anyway, this is The Letter. With BEF, June 10th, dear wife, Oh, blast this pencil. Here, Bill, lend's a knife. I'm in the pink at present, dear. I think the war will end this year. We don't see much of them square-headed uns. We're out of harm's way, not bad fed. I'm longing for a taste of your old buns. Say, Jimmy, spare's a bite of bread. There don't seem much to say just now. You what? Then don't, you ruddy cow. And give us back me cigarette. I'll soon be home. You mustn't fret. My feet's improving, as I told you of. We're out in rest now. Never fear. By crumbs, but that was near. Mother might spare you half a sov. Kiss Nell and Bert when me and you... Eat! What the hell? Stand to, stand to. Jim, give us a hand with pack on, lad. Oh, Christ, I'm hit. Take hold. Aye, bad. No damn your iodine. Jim here. Right, my old girl, Jim. There's a dear.
Now, I'm ambivalent about this one because I actually like it. And you liked it. That's why you picked it, wasn't it? But what do you think? What do you think about it? Tell us. Express your inner feelings, Gary.
I don't have any at all, really. I told you, it goes straight over my head. I think the interesting thing is that at the time, you know, dropping the H, officers at the time found incredibly funny. You know, they thought that was really amusing to affect a false working class accent.
And that's all over. We've been working on a military humour of the Great War book. And it's all over young officers' letters, isn't it? It's second lieutenants, captains, that kind of thing. Are they being affectionate or are they being patronising and offensive?
Well, I'd say it's patronising and offensive, but I would, wouldn't I? But then, bizarrely, it's how I talk. I just said ow.
And what do you think of this poem? Why did you pick it?
Well, I just think that it's intermingling the life in the trench and he's having a conversation with his pal whilst writing the letter to his wife, and the two are becoming enmeshed. And,
So it's a clever
it's
poem.
It's very clever and interesting that it was written, you know, in Ripon, well away from the line. Now, you know, lots of people know this, but Wilfred Owen died on the 4th of November 1918 during the crossing...
It's the only thing that happened on that day on the Western Front. There was no Battle of the Somme.
Well, it's the crossing of the Sambre-Oise Canal, which is a fantastic achievement. But what I found surprising in looking at this is that actually he was promoted the day after he died to lieutenant.
That's you might get promoted to full corporal the day after you die.
That's probably the only chance I've got of getting it, yeah. Now, it's also said and widely known that his mother received the telegram informing her of his death on Armistice Day as the bells were ringing out in celebration. Now, for those of you who want to know a bit more, the Wilfred Owen Association was formed in 1989, and you can find that on the internet, and it's got lots of interesting information about Wilfred Owen, and there are a number of memorials to his life, both in this country and in France, and there are details on that website, and I highly recommend you have a look.
Now, who's our next poet? This is my choice, and this is a cliche. Who's our next poet, Gary?
Well, our next poet is Siegfried Sassoon, and the poet that you poem that you've selected is well known. It's The General.
Yes, The General. Now, so who is Sassoon? Well, let's talk about him after the poem. Now, the poet, the general. So I'll try. I'm not going to do any silly voices because it's hard enough reading bloody poetry without messing about. So here it goes. God, I'm strangely nervous. Good morning, good morning, the general said when we met him last week on our way to the line. Now, the soldiers he smiled at are most of them dead, and we're cursing his staff for incompetent swine. He's a cheery old card, grunted Harry to Jack as they slogged up to Arras with rifle and pack. But he did for them both by his plan of attack. What's going on here? Now, I'm quite an admirer of Siegfried Sassoon. 1886 he was born. He died in 1967. And I actually played in the commemorative 100th year of the cricket match I was young then. In about the 1990s, can't remember, of the Flower Show match. I like Siegfried Sassoon, nicknamed Mad Jack, a very brave young officer, very, very brave young officer. But what's he saying here in this poem? Come on, you can work out what is he saying about generals, about the war?
Basically, that the British attacks are usually badly planned and involve mass slaughter. And you could argue that that's partly responsible for the terribly generic view that people still hold.
Yeah, so basically they're saying it's just defenceless men charging into machine gun fire, and it's crude and ineffectual, and the generals, it may be encouraging, but him and his staff are dooming you.
Yeah, and actually cheerfully oblivious to the suffering of the men.
And whose side is Sassoon taking? It's obvious, isn't it?
He's taking the side of the men.
But is he really one of the men?
No, he came from an incredibly wealthy family. It's described as middle class, but they had more money than Croesus, frankly, who had about four bob.
That's very intellectual. Well, these poems are rubbing off on you. Something's rubbing off on you. What about staff officers? What do you think of staff officers?
Well, we've had lots of discussions about staff officers throughout the podcast. You particularly have made the point on a number of occasions about the value of good staff work. And
are you saying I repeat myself?
You do repeat yourself. But also, what's become clear is where staff officers are not very good, they are usually removed. I remember a case in point when we were doing the Boer War. That doesn't sort of lend itself to the poem, does it? The staff officer was rubbish. So he sacked them all. It would have been a very short poem.
And literary critics point out that the poem's clever because there's an initial affection for the general. But then by the last line, he's given full responsibility for what's happening. And the affection sort of freezes. But this is another theme we've had. Are generals, are they created fully formed, or have they been young men ever?
No, and we've made the point again in earlier podcasts that, you know, I get quite annoyed that people are defined by one moment. Now, these are, you know, often crucial moments in history, but they've had lives that take them there. You know, Haig, for example, was a young officer in the Sudan. He didn't just arrive. And the problem is that programmes like Blackadder, for example, where they portray Melchior as a sort of caricature of all the British generals, and that stays in the psyche of the public. And indeed, I think you're going to read again a parody of this poem, The General, which...
Yeah, this comes from a Lieutenant McClymont. I've forgotten where I saw it. That's fantastic. A good historian always reveals where his sources are. But Lieutenant McClymont wrote this, and he calls this The General. Good morning, the general said as he passed down the line with a wound in his head. Now, he knew he was wounded by the way that he bled, and when he got to the base, the poor bugger was dead. And that reminds us of what how many generals were killed in action.
Yeah, I think it was about 72, wasn't it? Something like that.
It's a lot, isn't it? Killed and wounded. And that, to me, means that, again, I like this poem. Well, it's a limerick, basically. So I do like it. But is it good history?
No. Which makes me wonder why we're doing this. Mind you, we never do good history.
Oh, you are chirpy. Now, the next one I'd like to dedicate to a friend of ours called James Thompson, who does a wonderful reading of this poet. I mean, he's a poetic type by nature.
Well, he's from Yorkshire.
Yes, and Yorkshire people are usually of a poetic ilk, so to speak. Now, this is by Patrick Shaw Stewart, and it's called I Saw a Man This Morning. Well, it is to me, anyway. I think it's just the first line. I don't think it's got a name. Tell me a bit about Patrick Shaw Stewart. You're going to read this, but give us an inkling as to what we're going to get.
Well, he was born in 1888. He was the son of a major general. He was the son of a major general, and he was educated at Eton and Balliol College in Oxford. Now, interestingly...
A normal working class lad, then.
Yeah, and interestingly, his chum... And that's an interesting thing. These people were all known to each other. They were all friendly, you know.
What are you saying?
They were very well known to each other in some cases. And Sassoon, for example, knew Wilfred Owen, knew Graves. So it's a very tight-knit circle. And Patrick Shaw Stewart's friend Rupert Brooke described him as the most brilliant man they'd had in Oxford for 10 years. Now, that's not very long, to be fair, is it, 10 years?
Also, I'm not sure if that inbred collection of no-marks is really any sort of standing, but there you go.
Well, to be fair, Rupert Brooke was a genius, and when you know, he was the leader of the glitterati, as they were known, and you know, he was part of that that Hood Battalion glitterati with Brooke, Charles Lister, Frederick Kelly, Dennis Brown. You know, these are all significant men in their time. Now, I think this is the only known poem by Patrick Shaw Stewart.
Yeah, he wrote it. He wrote it during a. They were at rest. Briefly, the Hood Battalion came out at rest to Imbros in mid-July, and it was only found. I mean, it's not published as such. It was found after his death in 1917 in a collection of. Now, this I always love the way it's, this is presented as if everyone should go, yes, of course. Well, I've read that myself. So it's found in a collection of Alfred Housman's poetry, A Shropshire Lad. Now, have you read Housman's, or is it Housman? I don't even know.
It's Housman, I think.
Are you just looking up on your
shelves? Yeah, I'm just looking at my shelves. I'm just checking.
Is it a well-thumbed copy?
Yes. Oh, yes. It's definitely well-thumbed.
How do you pronounce Housman then? Housman.
Housman, as you just did. Housman.
Oh, that's good. Now, I like Patrick Shaw Stewart because he wasn't quite as good looking as the others. He had difficulty getting off with a young lady. And he's just not quite as good looking as Brooke. He's not quite as flexible in affairs of the heart as Rupert Brooke.
He's also not as witty as Brooke, is he? You know, often
Rupert Brooke's staggeringly funny.
Yeah. You know, you sit. I do understand some of Brooke's poetry. You read it and you think he can't mean that, when in fact he means it. You know, so
you mean it's a bit like your limericks.
Yes, yes. Now,
can you ever just
now, right. Patrick Shaw Stewart was killed, wasn't he, in action on the 30th of December 1917, and he just refused to
come out
of the line because he'd had his ear torn off by flying shrapnel just a few minutes previously.
He probably should have done in retrospect, although then he'd have been hit by a shell on the way back. I think a point you want to make quite firmly. We're not being rude about these people. Sassoon, Patrick Shaw Stewart, these people are brave officers and competent. I mean, he was a company commander, I think, by then. Or was he even the battalion commander? Can't remember. Second in command. Can't remember. But they're brave, competent officers. Now, this poem is difficult. And we all think of James, that poetic soul, stood in Gallipoli reciting this. Tears fell down our faces. We couldn't stop laughing, could we? But go on, let's have this poem. I think this is quite brilliant in parts. So let's go through it.
No, I think that's unfair. I think it is actually quite brilliant. And when you consider this is his only known work, you know, I think that you've got to realise that this is a creation of the circumstances and how he was feeling. It's evident how he's feeling about the death of his friend. So this is called I Saw a Man This Morning. I saw a man this morning who did not wish to die. I ask and cannot answer, if otherwise wish I. Fair broke the day this morning against the Dardanelles. The breeze blew soft, the morn's cheeks were cold as cold seashells. But other shells are waiting across the Aegean Sea. Shrapnel and high explosive, shells and hells for me. Oh, hell of ships and cities, hell of men like me. Fatal second Helen, why must I follow thee? Achilles came to Troyland, and I to Chersonese. He turned from wrath to battle, and I from 3 days' peace. Was it so hard, Achilles? So very hard to die? Thou knewest, and I know not, so much the happier I. I will go back this morning, from Imbros over the sea. Stand in the trench, Achilles, Flame Captain, shout for me.
Now, despite you adding an unwanted amount of humour to the second but last verse, I think those last two verses are stunningly brilliant. So funny, I think this is a good piece of work. A couple of the puns, which literary geniuses say are amazing, like seashells and shells and hell and Helen, they sort of fly over me a bit because to me they're just obvious. Not because I'm bright, but because they're nearly the same word. They're not great puns, are they?
No, but you've got to think about where they are. You know, for the educated officer of that time, they were in Troy. You know, it was the Iliad, wasn't it?
We've looked across to it, haven't we?
Yeah. So they're in a part of the world that they associate with romantic stories and you know, great gods and the Greek tales. So it's not surprising that he's put things in that way, not at all.
I'd also like to mention my chum Roger Chapman, who read this on Patrocles. It's a mound that's meant to be Patrocles' grave mound. Patrocles is Achilles' chum.
That's how he liked to be known. He used to introduce himself. Hi, he'd say, I'm Patrocles, Achilles' chum, he would
say. I think
say.
He probably did, to be absolutely honest. but Roger was reading his poem on the man's tomb. And at that time, our brilliant guide, Bullent Yorkwess's mobile phone went off at the very most dramatic moment of, was it so hard, Achilles? Dring, 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 dring. I just got to answer this. Fantastic. Poetry. What is the last line about? You interpreted, you've looked this up. What does that line, Flame Captain, shout for me? What does it mean, Gary? What does it mean?
I think it's making reference to the terrifying blaze of flames that spun from Patrocles' head as he lets loose a deafening cry. Oh, yeah, sorry, Achilles' head. Because Patrocles is dead. He's dead, mate. Your chum. And that sends panic through the Trojan troops. And I think it's alluding to that. But, I mean, this is all about the death of his friend, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's great. I like that one. So we pass that one. Now, the next one is
yours. We pass that one. Tick.
Yeah. Now, this next one was chosen by you. And can you explain a bit about the background as to why you chose it? I thought you chose it because it was short and easy to read.
Do you know what? Having said right at the start that I don't understand things, I understand this and I like it. And I think, you know, as people will soon realise, there's a brevity to this. But that's what makes this brilliant.
What's it called?
It's by H.W. Garrod. And it's
Heathcote. Heathcote.
Oh, well, you'd know because you bought the book off the back of this.
I did.
Heathcote Garrod, and it's called Epitaph, Nerve Chappelle. Now,
so tell me a bit about him.
He was born in Wells in 1878.
He was quite old by the time. Was he at Nerve Chappelle? Well, carry on, sorry.
He was educated at Bath College and Balliol College, Oxford, again.
That's a coincidence, isn't it? It's as if all these knobs went to the same place.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? He was a teacher. He was a tutor in English literature at Corpus Christi College, Oxford. And during the First World War, he worked on the civilian side. He was first with the Ministry of Munitions and then in the Ministry of Reconstruction. So he didn't serve. Well, he served in a different way, should we say. Now,
which is strange that he wrote this poem then in one sense. Now, he was quite a witty type, this. And you found another quote from him when he was, some woman was offering him a white feather or something. And he comes, now this quote is worth the price of admission as well. Tell us it, Gary.
Well, bearing in mind that at this time, people who were seen to be of military age were often accosted in the street as to why they weren't in uniform. And it's said
why,
that...
why they weren't fighting to defend civilization.
Yeah, it said that he was accosted by a woman who asked him that exact question. Why are you not serving with the soldiers fighting to defend civilization? And his reply was, "Madam, I am the civilization they are fighting to defend." Which is quite brilliant.
Oh, I like this man. Now, you were going to explain to me where this comes from, because tell me the background. What's it based on, Gary?
Well, as you know, because we did feature it recently, it's based on Simonides' famous epitaph for the dead at Thermopylae.
So it's called Epitaph at Neuve-Chapelle. Now, it's going to take you a while to get yourself ready to read this, so yeah. We'll give you time.
Thanks.
La, 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 la. Me.
Right. Tell them at home there's nothing here to hide. We took our orders, asked no questions, died.
Wow. I think it's good.
I think it's brilliant.
It gets its message across. And now we're going to read about four poems following it. Well, in a bit. Poems that are trying to get things across in fancy language and all the rest of it. This is simple and hard-hitting, would you not say?
I think it's brilliant. I think, there have been lots of other versions, haven't there? I think you've referenced one by William Golding called
Stranger. Well, it's a particularly bad one. Read that one for us. It's appalling.
I don't have it, so I can't read it. Stranger, but I've got a line from it. Stranger, tell the Spartans that we behaved as they would wish us to and are buried here.
Well, and what does it all mean?
Well, the start, tell them at home. Well, tell them at home because we don't want to hide anything from them. Or tell them at home because there's nothing here for them to hide. Although, actually, they were hiding things everywhere, weren't they? All over the place.
Ooh. And it's not taking orders different from behaving as they would wish us to. So there's differences. It's all, it's compulsory sacrifice now, isn't it? It's all very, very intellectual, isn't it? So take us through the three steps of this episode. This is a sort of crap analysis that ruins a poem. That's why we're doing it. We're saying this is crap, this analysis. So take us through the steps that Gerard goes through.
Well, I found this analysis rather helpful. It's, Garrett's epitaph, it's three steps, isn't it? It couldn't be many more. It's only four lines. We took our orders, asked no questions, died. So if they'd not taken their orders, but of course
they had to,
yeah. Or if they'd asked questions.
Were the questions to ask? Did they know the questions to ask? It's all mystery, isn't it?
But the suggestion is that their fate might have been avoided after all, which is nonsense, really, isn't it? Soldiers, they asked no questions. That recalls the previous line and hints that things were being hidden from them. And now that they're dead, there's nothing here to hide because they're dead.
No, I can see that. I mean, if they're dead, then you don't need lie to them.
No, you only have to lie to living soldiers, don't you?
Well, to think all that, and I thought it was just an ace couple of lines, or, you know, but...
Well, I thought it was, and I still do think it's an ace couple of lines. I think it's brilliant.
Right, we're moving on now, and the next one is taken from the 17th Highland Light Infantry. I'm not going to read it in a Scottish accent, because people
complain generally.
They get the pitchforks and lighted brands out.
Well, I think
they?
You're lucky because it's by T. Roxburgh and he was from Edinburgh or Berg.
Well, so I'll read it in an English accent then, and it'll be fine. Now this is not a good poem, but this is common of the poetry that is. Again, we found all this stuff while we're working on our new book, haven't we, Gary? It's all over the place. Bad poetry. This is probably the best. Because it finishes with a joke, but often it's they use this fake working class accent. But this is T. Roxburgh. I haven't even looked up who he really is, and it's in that 17th history. Here we go. A white mist drifts across the butts. The grass is white with morning frost. Think of all the sleep I've lost, and know I cannot shoot for nuts. The blood-red flag is lowered now, the blinking bull's eyes in a row. Benignly watch my trigger go. They know they're safe enough, I trow. I trow? What the... Anyway. The five rounds spent, I linger still, with hope and fear in bitter strife. Yet all the while, you bet your life, I know my shots are in the hill. Debosh ye from the parapet, you see my rifle aimed at you. Do not, I beg, retire from view. I'll only use the bayonet. Now, I like this poem because I know my shots are in the hill means you'd understand this because you from your training that's into the well, the butt, isn't it?
Yeah, into the sandbank. The sandbank at the back.
And I like the fact I won't hit you with a rifle, so I'm going to bayonet you. That's right. What do you think of this poem? Because I picked it and. You've been strangely quiet about it. I notice your notes have nothing in about it, as if you weren't interested.
No, I just found it.
By no, do you mean yes?
No, I mean, what I found most interesting was your flowing accent from Craggy Welshman to Craggy you. It was quite... Quite
Look,
interesting.
A Scottish person has said that your Scottish accent is rubbish, and whilst mine's rubbish, he said I can go aye.
Yeah, my parents were both Scottish, so clearly I cannot do a Scottish accent.
All four of my grandparents were Scottish.
Yeah, grandparents.
To the vast shame of the entire family.
Parents. No, but it's interesting, isn't it? But it's, you know, and anybody who's been in the armed forces can identify with.
I think it's a good. So that's. I would say it's bad poetry, but to us, we probably like it more than some of the ones that are going to follow. Because we're going to run into what I call bad poetry coming up. The next one you picked, though, you quite liked the next one, didn't you? It's Edmund Blunden, The Watchers. Now, I'll tell you a bit about him because you've got the poem to read. You're probably going to have to. It's not easy to read, is it? So Blunden, he was born in 1896. He was awarded a scholarship to Queen's College, Oxford. Do you know, it's strange how they all seem to go to the Oxford University. But war put a stop to all that and nonsense. And he's commissioned to the Royal Sussex Regiment. Can't remember which battalion. 7th? Can't remember. 12th? And he served on the Western Front. And it's all commemorated in a book we both got, Undertones of War, which came out in 1928. And it's well in the miserable suffering thing. He was after the war, he became an all-purpose literary critic, journalist, tutor at Merton College and travel writer. And he died in 1974.
I thought all the Great War poets died in the war.
Well, I mean, everybody died in the Great War, as you well know. Nobody lived because of the generals.
Oh, true.
Right, so let's have your best effort at The Watchers.
Yeah, this is The Watchers by Edmund Blunden. I heard the challenge, who goes there? Close kept, but mine through midnight air. I answered and was recognised, and passed, and kindly thus advised. There's someone crawling through the grass by the red ruin, or there was, and them machine guns been a-firing all the time the chaps was wiring. So, sir, if you're going out, you'll keep your head well down, no doubt. When will the stern find who goes there, meet me again in midnight air, and the gruff sentry's kindness when will kindness have such power again? It seems as now I wake and brood, and know my hour's decrepitude, that on some dewy parapet the sentry spirit gazes yet, who will not speak with altered tone when I am last, am seen and known.
Now, I didn't understand this poem at first, but I now get the vague idea that this is in later life and he's looking back on this sentry and it seems to haunt his thoughts. And you want to say something about him, don't you? I mean, because Blunden was deeply affected by the war, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was haunted by it all his life, and it seemed that he lived in that world rather than the real world.
That's what he actually said, isn't it?
Yeah,
and that's what that sounds for some. Sometimes it seems to him as if that's more real than his actual life. He never really moved on, did he, as they say?
Well, yeah, but you can understand that.
You can. So do we like that one or not?
I think it flows well. And I think, you know, there's a little bit of the dropping the H's to you know, yeah, to affect
the guy coming in. I thought it was just you at first, but then I looked at the text.
No, there is a little bit of it. And, you know, the other way of doing it is to drop the G at the end of wiring and things like that. So there's a bit of that in there. But actually, it flows brilliantly well. And you can imagine somebody coming in and updating the Sentry that, you know, there's a bit of firing going on while the working party's been out.
And he's looking back at the time when he's your age and looking at you now, I could see you. You've got sort of decrepitude, is sort of, would that word would sum you up?
Yeah, I'm not sure he was my age in 1914 because I'm 59, but
he didn't write it then. He wrote it in some other years.
Yes, but I think he would have been somewhat younger than 59 when he was coming in from patrol.
59 and still lovely.
But the other thing it does is it emphasises some of the more mundane stuff. You know, it wasn't all going over the top, going out and fixing the wiring, for example. You know, maintaining the trenches. That all had to be done, dangerous though it was. You know, it was stuff that had to go on a daily basis.
Now, nobody cares but what we think. I'm making that clear. And I understand that.
Not even us.
Not even us. You make your own mind up about any work of art. The next one is you chose it and then gave it to me to read. And I understand why you gave it to me to read. This is Frederick Manning, The Face, brackets Gillamore. He was born, well, tell us a bit about him.
Well, he was born in Sydney, Australia in 1882.
Not Sydney, somewhere else.
No, Sydney, Australia. And at 16, he was sent to England to live with the family friend, you know, a family friend. Yeah. And in 1914, he joined up and served as a private in the King's Shropshire Light Infantry. Now, after the war, in 1929, he published his war novel, at first anonymously, in a limited edition of just 520 copies.
Sounds like my book.
Yeah, it was privately printed under the title The Middle Parts of Fortune. Now, he wanted to remain anonymous and let his story speak for himself.
When I read the first line of my recent book, Evacuation, I wished I'd been anonymous.
Well, I think you'll be anonymous thereafter. Now, he wanted to remain anonymous because he wanted the story to speak for itself. And he states that he would have wrote was fictional, but you sort of sense that this was said to protect men who he would not want to think he sort of characterised unfairly, because he also says that he felt he was making a record of their words, which you can't really do if it's fictional, and had heard the voices of ghosts whilst he was writing. Now, originally, the obscenities in the book restricted the circulation, and an expurgated version, Her Private's We, which is an interesting title, appeared in 1930, and he died in London in 1935.
That's
so quite
young.
A young man, yeah.
Have you got these books? Because I've got them, but I couldn't get on with them. I didn't like them. They're very, very popular and highly regarded, but I don't like semi-fictionalised stuff. Have you read them? Or
no, the only one I've got that semi-fictionalised is Robert Graves, I think. That's the only one I've ever
read. Oh, are you saying Robert Graves is fictionalised? How controversial.
No. Well, it is fictionalised.
I'm going to try. This is really difficult. The Face, Gillamore. Out of the smoke of men's wrath, the red mist of anger, suddenly, as a wraith of sleep, a boy's face, white and tense, convulsed with terror and hate, the lips trembling. Then a red smear falling. I thrust aside the cloud, as it were tangible, blinded with a mist of blood. The face cometh again, as a wraith of sleep. A boy's face, delicate and blonde, the very mask of God, broken. Now, you chose it. Why did you choose it?
Because I like your face. Because, you know, this is a man having nightmares. And that's why I chose it. This is not contemporaneous. You know, he's looking back. He's having trouble sleeping. And when he closes his eyes, he sees the face of probably a long-dead comrade. And I just think that I just think that it tells its own story, and this could apply whatever the war. You know, this could be the Great War, this could be the Second World War, this could be Vietnam, it could be anywhere.
I find it difficult the way it's written, the thing. It's almost as if he's trying to make it too clever. I don't know.
Yeah, but often
perhaps I'm just too dumb to understand it.
Well, no, I think that's unfortunately one of the views I have of poetry, that sometimes they are being too clever. Certainly too clever for me.
I'm going to give an illustration. I think they try and obfuscate the meaning by using words that are different, are difficult to understand, as in obfuscate. That they'd love to stick that in a poem if they could. And I think they're deliberately difficult. And I'm afraid that the next one, which is also your choice, you are much more cultured than me, Herbert Read, The Happy Warrior. Now tell us a bit, because I find this one slightly difficult. Tell us about Herbert Read then.
The man stood by the garden gate. He was too late to obfuscate.
That's not Herbert Read.
No. Now I like this, but for probably all the wrong reasons.
Well, this is The Happy Warrior, isn't it?
Yeah,
this is
Herbert Read's The Happy Warrior. Now, Read, he studied at Leeds University, and his studies were interrupted by the war, as were a number of people's, and he served with the Yorkshire Regiment on the Western Front.
Fine body of men.
Yeah. Now, he was
bad-tempered, grumpy, miserable, but a fine body.
Now, he was commissioned. He was promoted to captain. He won the DSO and the MC in 1918. So, again, a brave man. His best-known poem...
That's what we're going to do, isn't it? The best.
Yeah, his best-known poem describes a soldier killing a German, and it concludes with, "This is the happy warrior." Now,
well, let's look at the end. Let him hear it first, then. And then we'll have...
"This is the happy warrior. His wild heart beats with painted sobs. His strained hands clench an ice-cold rifle. His aching jaws grip a hot, parched tongue. His wide eyes search unconsciously. He cannot shriek. Bloody saliva dribbles down his shapeless jacket. I saw him stab and stab again. A world-killed Boche. This is the happy warrior. This is he."
Now, I don't know what's going on here. Give us an idea.
It suggests that he's stabbing an already dead man.
Who is stabbing him?
Well...
Did you see what I mean? I find... It all switches about.
Well, who's the happy warrior? Because, you know, is the happy warrior enjoying the killing? Or I actually started thinking, well, is the happy warrior the dead man? You know, happy that he's had a warrior's death, for example.
So you're saying it's ambivalent.
I couldn't possibly say that for a number of reasons. But it's also being told as if somebody's watching. You know, it's a very odd perspective, and the end of it is as if...
What's this hot parched tongue business? It's ice cold rifle, but a hot parched tongue. I don't understand that.
And again, if you're watching, how do you know about his tongue? It's a very strange perspective.
And whose tongue is it? Is it the bloke stabbing or the bloke being...
And it also just sort of tails away at the end, doesn't it? And this is he.
I quite like that. I mean, the Happy Warrior. I mean, we know someone who was called the Happy Warrior, don't we? It's Ian Hamilton.
Oh, of course, yes. That was his one of his nicknames.
Right, so now we're on to another favourite of yours. I am impressed by your choice of poetry. You've really covered the bases of miserableness. And this is Robert Graves' Dead Boche. Now, Robert Graves, you've been reading him recently to get some quotes for our book, and he was Robert von Ranke.
Fine old English name.
Born into a middle-class family in Wimbledon, 1895. He was a son of a bishop.
So
and behaved
he's
like it.
The son of a preacher, man.
And like all sons of bishops and bishops, he had no morals whatsoever. He was educated at Charterhouse. In fact, he'd won a place there, hadn't he? Commissioned to the 3rd Royal Welsh Fusiliers. Published the first volume of poems over the... I can't say that.
Brazier.
Thank you. I always end up as a bra with me, in 1916. Badly wounded on the Somme, shot through the lung, a shell fragment, 16. Spent the rest of the war in UK. Post-war, he writes Goodbye to All That, 1929, which was revised and republished several times. Great success, lost him nearly all his friends, most noticeably Siegfried Sassoon. I don't think he ever spoke to him again. They thought it was over the top, full of lies, and he refused to correct things.
But it's never been out of print. It's been in print ever since.
How many years is that?
Oh, more than 10.
He really, I mean, I know him best from I, Claudius, because that was a programme we all watched in the 1970s, because there were occasionally women with no clothes on.
Well, also the acting was fantastic.
It was. It was great. Who was the star? Who was Claudius? It was someone.
Derek Jacobi.
That's it. You're so educated. So he died in 1985. I remember I tried to get permission to go out to interview him.
Oh, yeah, because he moved out to Mallorca, didn't he? He lived and died in Mallorca.
Was it Mallorca?
Yeah, I think so.
It was some island in the Mediterranean. Anyway, the War Museum refused to let me go. Now, this poem you're going to read, and it's difficult. I don't like this one. It's called Dead Boche, based on the fighting at Mametz Wood and the Somme in 16. What he's trying to do is illustrate the horror of war, and I think it's just a list of nasty things. But you like it.
I do.
Or do you?
I do.
Do you like it?
No, I do like it. Dead Boche. To you who'd read my songs of war and only hear of blood and fame, I'll say you've heard it said before. War's hell, and if you doubt the same, today I found in Mametz Wood a certain cure for lust of blood, where propped against a shattered trunk, in a great mess of things unclean, sat a dead Boche. He scowled and stunk, with clothes and face a sodden green, big-bellied, spectacled, crop-haired, dribbling black blood from nose and beard.
Why do you like it? Because, do you know what? It's coming apparent. You were the one who said you didn't like poetry, and yet you've liked a lot of these poems. Whereas I'm ambivalent about that one.
No, you're assuming I've chosen them on the basis that I like them, which is not the case. Some of them I've chosen because I wanted you to read them, such as The Happy Warrior, and then you made me read it. So you mustn't read too much into the choices.
You said you liked it. Why did you like it?
Because I don't actually like it. I think that this is...
You said you did. Listeners, go back and hear.
I think it's simply that I like a representation of graves. I think this is so typical of graves. If you do read, and I recommend you do read, Goodbye to All That, you know, he's often presenting things in a particular way. He presents himself as a very popular officer within the battalion, when in fact he's not. I just think this couldn't have been written by anybody else, I don't think, because I think it just says Robert Graves all the way through it. And, you know, there are some truisms in it, isn't there? They're propped against a shattered trunk in a great mess of things unclean. That's going to be true. Yeah. You know, that is going to be true. He scowled and stunk. Yeah, very probably. How long had the body been there? Yeah, I think big-bellied, spectacled, crop-haired describes me perfectly, actually, at the moment.
I was being kind.
Yeah, all right. But, you know, there are a number of poems from the First World War. There's a number of books. You know, this comes from something called The First World War, which is edited by Martin Stephen. And I just think it is Robert Graves. You know, there's probably better ones, but this, for me, shows his personality.
Now, the next one, for me, doesn't show the man's personality, because Rupert Brooke, The Soldier. We both picked this. Tell me a bit about Rupert Brooke. I've got a story I want to tell about him. So do you give the outline of who is Rupert Brooke?
Well, again, he was born, as all of them were, in 1887.
Were they all born in 1887?
No, they were all born, though. And now, interestingly, he was described as the handsomest young man in England.
Sorry.
Not Britain, England.
The Scots are a different
standard. There's a whole race of good-looking, handsome men in Scotland, hence me, of course. He was gorgeous, multisexual, and he was already...
What does that... yeah, never mind.
Multisexual, Peter. I think you can work that out. He's already a famous poet when he enlisted into the Royal Naval Division. He fought with the R&D at Antwerp.
Now, people always go say he wasn't in action or try and imply. But that was quite a serious business. And there were a lot of casualties, mainly prisoners. But he was in the war.
You've also got to think about when that was. The R&D was largely untrained when it went to Antwerp. And it certainly didn't have all the support necessary. And, you know, he was lucky to escape what's been described as a Churchillian fiasco.
Luckily, Churchill will never affect his life again.
No. So so before he joins the Hood Battalion, before long he joins the Hood Battalion, he becomes the head of what we're describing as the glitterati. We've mentioned them earlier.
They are my favourites.
Now, sadly, and it is sadly, because I think he would have wanted a different death. He died of blood poisoning from an infected mosquito bite en route to Gallipoli in April 1915. I think it was a bite on his lip, Pete, wasn't it?
He was, yeah.
Now
he becomes a national symbol, I think, of tragic wartime loss to a whole, of a really promising Georgian, if you like, they used to call themselves sometimes, generation.
Yeah, and if you think he died in 1915, his poems were published posthumously in May 1915. The collection of work that he did, the body of work that he did in such a short space of time, is quite terrific, really.
Now, the thing about this poem is a serious poem, but I like to think of Rupert Brooke, in other words, one of his correspondence, his letters are full of hilarious things about 15-inch guns. And if you ever think, is this man taking the piss or is he being rude? Then the answer with Rupert Brooke is he is. And my favourite story about him is that he was famous, legendary. And I remember being at a debate with some Rupert Brooke people when we went to the island of Skyros, which I believe is where the Daleks came from, and where he's buried. And it was interesting because at breakfast, there was two things that happened. One, they said, isn't that where Rupert Brooke's first lost his anal virginity, which caused me to spit out half my complex because I wasn't expecting that in his rather refined company. And then they went on to say, yes, and they had a debate between them as to whether it was more dramatic that Rupert Brooke had dived naked into a freezing cold pond with a gigantic hard-on and emerged flaccid, or had dived into the freezing cold pond flaccid and then emerged with a gigantic hard on. And I was able to help them in this because I was able to say, well, I think you'll find that it's more impressive diving in flaccid and coming out of a freezing cold pond with a gigantic hard on. So this was my insight into Rupert Brooke. You'll see I'm an intellectual.
And contribution to society.
Yeah, I think I helped them there.
You did, yeah.
Anyway, this is his poem. It's famous, The Soldier. If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England, there shall be, in that rich earth a richer dust concealed. A dust whom England bore, shaped, made aware, gave once her flowers to love, her ways to roam. A body of England's, breathing English air, washed by the rivers, blessed by the sons of home. Now, I find this poem strange. It's got a couple of great lines in it, hasn't it? But do you not think the rest is...
Well, it's of its time, isn't it? I mean, it's almost as if the body of an Englishman enhances the earth in which he's buried in that foreign field. You know, it's just of its time, Pete. But
it's a bit over the top. And it's almost like he thinks he's looking forward to dying a noble death.
Well, I think he may well have been. I think, if it could have been mapped out for him to go to Gallipoli, we're getting back into the realms of the Iliad again, and, have a noble death fighting for king and empire.
A new crusade.
Yeah, or bitten by a mosquito.
But there are a couple of great, like, there is a piece of England in that foreign language. You know, that there's some powerful images in there, but I'm not sure I like it. But we had to cover it.
And it's often used, isn't it? It's used in, if you watch documentaries or if there is any programming about poetry, it is the one that is used.
I think the first four lines are the best. I think after that it loses its way, to me. I noticed that in my songs. I remember writing a couple. A Backdoor Banging was one, and it just lost its way after.
I cannot believe that you have compared Backdoor Banging to The Soldier by Rupert Brooke.
Those Naughty Lumps are an excellent band and have many insights into the human condition. All leaving your back door unlocked, which is what that song's about.
Right, moving swiftly on.
Moving swiftly on, we come to our tour de force from A.P. Herbert. Which is that shit shooter, we call it. So what's going on? Who's A.P. Herbert, Gary?
Well, A.P. Herbert...
he's an intellectual, isn't he?
He is, and he was serving, I think, in the Royal Naval Division, wasn't he?
Yes, he was in the Hawk Battalion.
Yeah, and General Shute was appointed General Officer Commanding the Royal Naval Division in 1916. And to say that he had a difficult relationship with the officers of the Royal Naval Division is an understatement. But it was mutual. You know, they detested each other, frankly.
Well, he had Haig on his back saying that these divisions from Gallipoli were no good. He had Haig say, you know, and then on top of that, they affect all these ludicrous nautical affectations, so saying they're going ashore when they're going on leave and growing beards,
port side and starboard side, and
yeah, it's just, and it's affected, and they weren't that efficient when they came in. But you're going to read his poem, and this is what I found, because we'll talk about who General Shute is afterwards, but let you read the poem, because it's a wonderful piece of doggerel. I'm not sure I'd call it poetry.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to bear in mind, A.P. Herbert became very famous after the war. He was a very humorous writer. He was a legal satirist and a Member of Parliament. So, you know, he's a very clever man, and this is a very clever poem.
It is.
So it's called That Shit Shoot. The general inspecting the trenches exclaimed with a horrified shout, "I refuse to command a division, which leaves its excreta about." But nobody took any notice. No one was prepared to refute that the presence of shit was congenial compared to the presence of shoot, and certain responsible critics made haste to reply to his words, observing that his staff advisers consisted entirely of turds, for shit may be shot at odd corners, and paper supplied there to suit, but a shit would be shot without mourners if somebody shot that shit shoot.
Now, I think that's brilliant.
And it is. It's very
funny. Wow, did A.P. Herbert number shit a shoot. I mean, he really numbered him. But look, the thing is, who is... So it's Major General Cameron Shute. Who is he? He's a long-standing regular soldier. He didn't suffer fools gladly. He didn't court popularity. He was unquestionably high, very, very, very able general. And the most... The thing is that one thing is... The Royal Naval Division thought they knew it all because of Gallipoli, but they didn't, did they, Gary? They didn't know it all. And one great example is that that Shute insisted that they dug jumping off trenches before they attacked in the Battle of the Ancre. And those, on it was the 13th of November 1916, and they moaned like mad. But while they were waiting to go over the top, the Germans opened fire with 5.9s, and he saved a lot of their lives. Were they grateful, Gary?
No, probably not. But, I mean, bear in mind, they were committed very late in the Battles of the Somme, so, you know, they would have seen all the newspaper reports about the attacks on the 1st of July, for example. So he was very pragmatic in his approach. He wanted to stamp out what he saw as the indiscipline which would ultimately lead to problems when they went into the attack. And, frankly, he was right. And it was his and others' leadership that... was effective when it came to them being committed on the Ancre. And they should have realised the job that he did save lives, because it did. But he was a miserable, cantankerous old bastard, which in a general, as we well know, are qualities that are, you know, required.
There's a great story about one of his officers, and he's saying, "I believe you are deliberately standing here to hide this." There was some ammunition boxes buried in the mud. "I believe you were deliberately standing there to hide this from me." And the officer said, "Good God, if I'd known you were coming, this is the last place on earth where I should have been standing." Now, the thing about that is insolent beyond belief, and it's part of the Royal Naval Division thing. But you can't behave like that. You've got to be... You can't leave ammunition boxes lying about the place, buried in mud. Shoot is often right. So I think on balance, what I would say is, if I was analysing from what the poets you've looked at, who was more often right, poets or generals, I'd say the generals were more often right than the poets. What would you say?
I'd say that the poets had an opportunity that was granted to them in probably no other circumstances to put down on paper some fairly cutting remarks, shall we say, which, you know, they wouldn't have said to their faces. Perhaps A.P. Herbert would have done, but I don't think many of the others would.
I think the poems are... I think... What do we think generally about Poetry of the Great War? Does it have a value?
It's an outlet, isn't it? There's not, as far as I know, not many non-commissioned poets, as it
were. There were some.
But they do tend to be the officer classes, and they, you know, in these poems we picked today, they've all been to Oxford. I just think that it's of its time again, and
it's an elite viewpoint. It's look, there were some working class, and some I think.
Yeah, I mean Sarkey, I think, was working class, wasn't he?
There were some, but not that many. But there is an elite group that became famous. That's not their fault. That they became famous. I mean, Graves, Sassoon, Gray,
Owen. And it gave an opportunity for it. I think without the Great War, half of them would not have been recognised as poets. I think some would. I think Wilfred Owen would have been, for example. I think Sassoon probably would have been. And Graves was already writing poetry. But I think the majority of them just saw an outlet for how they were feeling, whether they were right or not.
Now, are the views expressed valid? Is the face, are things like that valid?
I don't really want to get into the analysis of it, because I think...
No, what I mean is, does it have a value in understanding the Great War?
No, because I don't think any of it does.
So, well, I differ slightly in that I think that the poetry has a part to play in an all-arms... understanding of the war. You need everything. You need to understand all the viewpoints, and it is a minority viewpoint which is part of the whole.
I think it's best served, and one of the favourite ones of today was the limerick type poetry. I think it's best served when it's irreverent and put in that way. And I'd like to finish with a poem, if I may, of my own, that I slaved over for 5 or 6 seconds. On Ilkley Moor, I sat and shat, like the cat in that hat.
Oh, I noticed you picked up a bit of the face's form there.
Yeah, and I should have dropped the H in that.
Well, on that note, we'll leave you. I hope you, some of you, have a look at some of the poets, poetry, and make your own minds up. That's what it's all about. Surely, the one thing about poetry is it's not. That those god-awful words, in my humble opinion, who else's opinion you're going to have? If you like it, it's good. And if you don't like it, it's not to you. And that's all that matters to you. In my humble opinion. Now, bugger off.
Cheers, Pete.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?